So as an illustrative example of the kind of thing you can do, let's let S be a semigroup with unit. Let me make this a discrete, say, countable thing. Okay. Then you can form the semigroup algebra just like you can form the group algebra. This is just a set of all finite sums of scalar combinations, scalar multiples of elements of your semigroup. And you multiply them in the obvious way. There's a linear structure, but there's also a multiplication. And basically you have alpha S times beta T is alpha beta times ST, which is an element of your semigroup. Okay? All right. Okay. And then we can say that, look at maps pi from S into B of H, homomorphisms. Okay. And we say that bounded if the soup pi of S is finite and it's contractive if the soup pi of S is equal to 1. And we can assume then that pi of E is the identity, so the non-degenerate, okay? Condition. And then extend in the obvious way CS by pi tilde of summation of alpha SS is summation of alpha S pi of S. And again, because of the finite sums, there's no problem here. And now we can talk about putting norms on MN of the group algebra by the norm of a matrix Xij is just the soup over all these representations pi, which are contractive, of the norm of the matrix pi tilde of X. Okay. And you take the soup over all such representations, and that gets you a family of norms. Okay. And, well, or semi-norms anyway, so let J be the set of all X and C of S, such that the norm of X is 0. And a lot of times you could check to see that that's trivial, but maybe not in general. But it's always an ideal in C of S. Okay. And we define the operator algebra of S to be C of S mod J together with this family of norms and the completion, okay? In the first norm. Okay, let me put an N here, if that's N by N. Okay. Okay. So, that's obviously an operator algebra. It's concrete operator algebra because you can take a direct sum of all of these representations. I mean, there's always a set theoretic issue. What do you mean by all? So you fix your Hilbert space, in this case, since I said S was countable, you can make your Hilbert space separable, look at all separable representations into one fixed Hilbert space, take a direct sum, okay? So that's a concrete operator algebra. These are matrices, yeah. Yeah, we've got this family of matrix norms, okay? So it's an operator algebra. It's the completion. I'm going to take the completion of it in the one norm, and then I have norms in all of the matrix algebras. It makes it an operator algebra. Okay. So, for example, take S to be the non-negative integers. Okay. Then, if pi of 1 is some t belonging to b of h, that forces pi of n to be t to the n. Okay, so pi is bounded if and only if p is power bounded. And pi is contractive if and only if t is a contraction. Okay, but if I have any polynomial in other words, P is equal to sum of AI z to the I equals 0 to sum n, right, then pi of p is the summation of ai t to the I. In other words, it's just p of t. Okay, so that we know that the norm of this p in this universal operator algebra then is the soup of the norm of p of t when we run over t less than or equal to 1. And by the Neumann's inequality, that's equal to the soup norm over the unit disk. Well, I guess to be fair, the Neumann inequality is that it's less than or equal to the soup norm over the disk, but that soup norm is attained if you take something like the bilateral shift, where it's just multiplication by z on L2 of the circle, and this is multiplication by p. Okay, so therefore the completion OA of Z plus is just the disk algebra. That's example one. In example two, if G is a discrete group. Okay, then if we have pi mapping G into B of H, a homomorphism, and norm of pi less than or equal to 1, this means that pi of G is less than or equal to 1, and pi of G inverse, which is just pi of G inverse, is less than or equal to 1. These two show that pi of G is unitary. So in other words, a contractive representation of a group is a unitary representation of the group. And conversely, we have a unitary representation of a group is norm 1, right? So therefore, the norm of some alpha GG in this universal operator algebra G is just then the soup of pi trivial. Okay. But this is the norm by definition. This is the norm of alpha GG in the group C star algebra, the full group C star algebra. Okay, so OA of G is C star also a G? And bounded representations are bounded representations of a group. And there's a so we showed that we did give Dieksmier's proof that if your group is amenable, every bounded representation is similar to a unitary representation. Okay. And there certainly are examples of non-amenable groups where it's known that they have bounded representations which are not similar. I guess it's now known anyone that contains a free group inside of it, for example. And it's conjectured, but it's still an open problem about whether every bounded representation of a group being similar to a unitary group representation implies that it's amenable.
So in this cell, you don't put topology on S. So any group must be discrete.
It's discrete, yes.
Even you're not a discrete
group. Yeah, I mean, I think you could do that. You could do variance if there's a topology, but okay. All right. Well, so here's the observation of Fletcher and Paulson, which is really really useful idea. Okay. So if we have put a norm on C of S, or MN as follows, or on MN. Okay, so if you let the norm of a matrix Xij be the infimum of all factor of the following information, where D is greater to 1, the C0 up to CD are scalar matrices. I'm not saying what size they are because I'm allowing various sizes. And D1 up to DD are diagonal matrices with diagonal entries from S. Okay. And I'll explain in a second what that is. Let me state the theorem. Then this norm, let me put a triple bar there. Then the triple norm is just the same as the OA of S norm. So let me say what do I mean? I mean, so we can take something like A, B, C, D, S1, S2, E, F, G, H, S3, let me be a little more imaginative than that. E, F, G, H, I, J, T1, T2, T3, K, L, M, N, O, P. Okay, that would be a typical kind of factorization. Okay. And if you multiply that out, you would then get elements. And what happens, well, I mean, obviously these semigroup elements are going to get multiplied. And you can, you, yes.
Just where do the diagonal matrices work in?
I think you forgot to write down the generic operation. Yeah, I think number C1 is to be touched back.
Oh, yeah. Well, I knew what I was talking about. Sure, you guys can exercise some imagination here. And Xij is equal to C0, D1, C1, D2, C2, dot, 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 DD, CD. Ah, yeah, that makes a little more sense, doesn't it? Thank you. Okay. So every matrix has such a factorization that, in fact, every matrix will have a fact such a factorization with probably just one diagonal entry if we make these matrices really, really big, you know, n by a lot. I mean, you can sort of see, you can just put all your all the TIs that occur in there down the diagonal, and this, these matrix multiplications will move them around. So every element has lots of such factorizations. Okay. The point is that this is that one. It gives us another way of calculating the norm. Okay. So So I'm going to prove that this is the same. Well, let's look at the operator algebra norm of this Xij. Well, because it has, if I take any one of those factorizations, then it's clear because this is an operator algebra norm, that this is less than or equal to the norm of C0 times the norm of D1 times the norm of C1 times the norm of D1. Okay. But these diagonal matrices, I mean, because it's an operator algebra norm, it's an operator space structure, the norm of a direct sum is just the max of the norms of the entries, but each of those are elements of your semigroup, they all have norm 1. Okay, so this is 1. So this is this product of the norm of the CIs from I equals 0 to D. Yeah, I guess we could have some sort of stupid semigroup which didn't have any representations. I can't imagine working with such a semigroup, but all right. We certainly get less than or equal to here. And then this is true also if I take the infimum over all representations, okay? So every time I factor it, I get an upper bound for the norm. If I take the infimum over all of those, I still have an upper bound, and I get the triple norm. Okay. So how do we go the other way? Well, the idea for the converse is to use the Bertrand-Sinclair theorem to check that this really is an operator algebra norm. So we have to check the axioms, but that's a lot easier than checking that this is an operator algebra, bare hands. Okay, so what do we have to check? Because the diagonal matrices which come from the semigroup, I'm only using those representations of the semigroup which are contractive to define the operator algebra norm back over here.
Okay.
Right? I'm using contractive ones. Here it is. Okay. All right, so we have have to check various things. One of the things you have to check is that if you take A and B scalar matrices, and then let's look at the triple norm of A, Xij, B, I have to show that that's less than norm of, usual norm of A times the triple norm of X times the usual norm of B. Okay, but that's clear because anytime I have a factorization of the X's as a C0, etc., I can stick an A on the front and a B on the back. So this is equal to the inf over all factorizations is less than or equal to the inf over these factor for these factorizations. And I'm going to use this factorization AC0 times D1, C1, CD, DD, CDB, okay, which is the inf, which is less than equal to the inf of norm of A times norm of C0, because that dominates this, times norm of C1, times norm of CD, times the norm of B, which is A times the triple norm of Xij times norm of B. Okay. So it's sort of built in, this factorization norm built in the fact that you're allowed to multiply on left and right by scalar matrices. Second thing I want to check is the direct sum. Suppose I have Xij direct sum from YKL. Okay. Well, again, I can factor Xij is equal to C0, D1, C1, D2, DD, CD, so that the product of the norms of the CIs is approximately equal to the triple norm of Xij. Alright, I mean that's, I could do it and take an inf, but let me instead choose one that's approximately right. Okay, and YKL is C0 prime, D1 prime, C1 prime, D prime, D prime, C prime, D prime. CI prime is approximately triple norm of YKL. All right, we want to fit them together. So the first thing is I want them to be the same length. Well, I can easily make them longer by sticking in diagonal matrices with the identity element down the diagonal and the identity matrix, okay? So I can make them longer by throwing in some extra identities, basically. Okay. So I can lengthen one by E times IN enough times, say D prime minus D times. So with some loss of generality, D and D prime are the same. Okay, and then I can normalize so that the norm of CI is equal to 1 if I is greater than or equal to 1, so that the norm of C0 is approximately equal to the triple norm of XIJ, and the norm of C0 prime is approximately the triple norm of YKL. Right? And then you just notice that if I take XIJ here, YKL down here, that that's equal to C0 prime times B1 prime times C1 prime D prime D prime. That's a factorization. And these guys are all norm 1, and these guys are all norm 1 because I've normalized them to be norm 1. And here you have a factorization where you get the norm, triple norm of this Sij x on ykl is less than or equal to the max of C0 and C0 prime, which is approximately equal to the max of these two triple norms. And greater than or equal to is clear. Okay, so in fact equal 3. We also have to check the triangle inequality to see that this really is a norm, because triangle inequality is not built into that formula. So let me take x and y, but they're on the same side. All right, so I have xij yij, say both n by n. Okay. And this time I'm going to factor them as before, but I'm going to take ci equal to 1 for 1 less than or equal to I, strictly less than d, and take norm of C0 equal to the norm of CD equal to the triple norm, approximately equal to the triple norm of XIJ to the 1/2. Okay? And so I'm just scaling them so that this is happening. Just multiply. And same thing for C0 prime equals CD prime, approximately equal to the triple norm of YIJ. And then you note that the sum, xij plus yij, is equal to c0 prime times d1 prime c1 prime d prime times cn prime. Oh, they got a D. Okay. Yes?
Just to go back to you, we should call it from 1 and 2.
If I took the direct sum of the xij's and the yij's.
You normalize x and y first, and then if I'm normalizing
a and b. Ah, yes. Yeah, you could do that. You could make them both norm 1 and alright. Seems to me there's a little trick there, too. It's no more sophisticated than this trick. no, less sophisticated, maybe, I should say. Anyway.
But at least you only two axes or
Okay. So anyway, let's continue with this proof. So here, everything in the middle is norm 1, and so that I get the triple norm of this is less than or equal to the norm of the matrix C0, C0 prime times the norm of CD, CD prime. And any matrix AB is less than the sum of the square root of the sum of the squares of the norm. So this is less than C0 squared plus C0 prime squared times the square root of CD squared plus CD prime squared, which is just approximately the triple norm of Xij plus the triple norm Yij. And we have to show that the multiplication is contractive, but that's very easy. Okay. Times yjk, that multiplication, that product will factor as c0 d1 c1 dd cd times c0 prime d1 prime dd prime c prime d prime, like that. And you just sort of combine these two into one in the middle as a scalar matrix, and so that you get that the triple norm of this is less than or equal to the product of the norms of the CIs times the product of the norms of the CI primes, which is approximately equal to the product of the triple norms if you chose that factorization properly. So that part's easy. So we verified the BRS axioms, and therefore this is an operator algebra norm. Okay, so back at the beginning, I showed that there was a simple argument that showed that the universal operator algebra norm was dominated by this triple norm. But this is an instance, right? There's a representation, pi, from C of S with the triple norm into B of H, which is a completely isometric isomorphism. Right, that's what the BRS theorem does for you. It takes an abstract operator algebra and represents it completely isometrically on a Hilbert space. Well, in particular, pi of s is less than or equal to 1 for all s and s. So this is an instance of a representation of OA of s. Yes? That's obvious, though. Yeah. for Nico. Okay, so anyway, so this is a particular instance of a representation of OA of S, so therefore you have that the norm of pi of a matrix Xij is less than or equal to the norm of Xij in OA of S, because it's the sup over all such representations. So that's the end. So what does it get you? It gets you a formula. Maybe not so practical for finding factorizations for specific elements, but very practical for dealing with it in a useful way. Okay. So for example, we can apply this to OA of Z plus, which is the disk algebra. And what you get is that the norm of a matrix of with polynomials, so if I have these Pij's polynomials, this is some n by n matrix, then this is the inf overall fact of this product of the norm of the CIs, I equals 0 to d, such that d is greater than or equal to 1. Pij can be written as a factorization of C0, D1, C1, D2, DD, CD. CIs are scalar, and the DIs are diagonal, and their entries are just elements of the semigroup, so they're powers of Z. And if we want, because you can make these representations longer, you can assume that these entries are either 1 or Z, right? Diagonal entries 1 or Z. You could even make them have just one Z, and you could make that Z be the first one, because obviously you can, once you've got it there, you can move it around by scalar matrices. So in fact, I could assume that this, I can even simplify it. I could just make it Z 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So that's kind of a surprising formula. Okay. Well, we can do the same for A of D squared. I mean, the reason is that if we take OA of Z plus squared, okay, what happens here? Well, you're having representations pi of 1, 0 is T1, pi of 0, 1 is T2, and you have T1 is less than or equal to 1, T2 is less than or equal to 1, and T1, T2 is equal to T2, T1. That's the commutativity of the semigroup. So you have two commuting contractions, and in two variables we have a von Neumann's inequality. So again, you have von Neumann's inequality says that if I take a polynomial in two variables, okay, or a matrix polynomial in these two variables, this is then the sup of Pij of T1 and T2 as we go over all commuting contractions. And so by von Neumann's inequality, that's less than the norm of Pij infinity, which is the sup of Pij of Z1, Z2, where Z1 and Z2 share both modulus equal to 1. And this is an equality because we can take L2 of the torus and take multiplication by Z1 and multiplication by Z2 as your two operators. And then for that particular choice of two unitaries, the norm is precisely the supernorm over the circle. Okay. So, but it does not work for n bigger or equal to 3 because von Neumann's inequality is false. Okay. So in fact, it gives you something different. Okay, I can still form the universal semigroup of OA of Z plus to the D, or to the N, n greater than or equal to 3, but this is not equal to A of D to the N. Okay, because the von Neumann inequality fails. The norm is the sup, the norm of Pij is the sup of the norm of Pij of P1 up to Pn, where Ti are less than or equal to 1, and Ti, Tj is equal to Tj, Ti. Okay. But this is strictly bigger and not equal to Pij infinity. Okay, this is a perfect time to take a break. Do you have the assignments for the, so for those students who handed in assignments, they can pick them up now.
Do you see the size of CI, the CID, they may not be the same?
That's right, they can be arbitrary size.
But in school, you don't need much of a different size, except
just at the beginning and the end, that's the only place you have to.
Yeah. The same size as matter.
But if you notice in these triangle inequalities, what does have to have the right size on the left of C0 and on the right of Cn, so these do fit together to make a row, and these do fit together to make a column. That is right.
The other two, the size doesn't matter.
No, that's so size is completely arbitrary except for the beginning and the end.
Same size.
That's right. No, in fact, you can't. I think. Okay. So this work of Letcher and Paulson was just in a small paper in the proceedings of the AMS, and it was obviously a nice thing, but maybe wasn't globally appreciated, but PVA appreciated it, and he souped this up in a really big way. So you define something called similarity degree. So I'm going to define two properties of an operator algebra. A is an operator algebra, unital. Okay. This has length, that's what PVA calls it, or factorization degree, which is what it's called in Paulson's book. B, I'm going to write L of A for length, if you can do that, you can get something comparable to the norm by factorization. Okay, so if there exists a K finite, so that for all matrices Xij in Mn of A, you can factor Xij as C0, D1, C1, D2, et cetera, up to D, CD. Now in this case, this D is fixed, it's this number D. It's not arbitrarily long like it is in the case of the integers there. Okay. If you can factor it in this way, where the CIs are scalar matrices, the DIs are diagonal with entries from the unit ball of A. Okay. So it's a diagonal A1, A2, A3, etc. Where those AIs are all known less than or equal to 1. And this product of the norm of the CIs, let me give it a name. Xi. The D norm is the nth over the product of the norms of the CIs from I equals 0 to D over all factorizations. And it's easy to see that when you allow arbitrary contractive entries, that you can always factor this even just as C0, D1, C1. You can just write all of the entries into D along the diagonal, and then you can move them around by C0 and C1 and make the matrix you want. So every matrix has factorizations at even a short length, but the point is that this particular D norm is less than or equal to a constant times its real norm. And Mn of A. So it's got length or factorization degree if you can factor it and that this factorization norm is comparable to the regular norm. Okay. And the second definition, A again is a unital operator algebra, has similarity degree. D, which is D of A, if there exists a...
How do you say D is the smallest number possible like that? When it loads on the length.
Yeah, so the length, I guess, yeah. It's the smallest D. Okay. Okay. Same thing here. If there's just a K finite, D smallest possible. Alright. If there's a K finite, so that pi mapping A to B of H or for all pi bounded homomorphisms pi CB is less than or equal to constant times norm of pi to the dth power. Proposition that D of A is less than or equal to L of A. Okay, and in fact you can use the same K. Okay. And the proof is straightforward because if I have xij and mn of A, and I want to compute the norm of this matrix whose entries are pi of xij. Okay. Well, by the fact that it has this factorization degree, means I can factor xij equals c0 d1 up to dd cd, product of the norms of the CIs from I equals 0 to d is less than or equal to, say, k times the norm of xij, and the DIs are diagonal of AI1, AI2, that are diagonal matrices. Okay, well, because this is a homomorphism, this is the norm of C0 diagonal of pi of A11, or let me write it as a diagonal matrix instead of writing the word diagonal. C1, pi of A21, pi of A22, down to CD. So it's clear that just by the triangle inequality, this is less than the norm of C0 times the norm of this. Well, this is a diagonal matrix. Each of these AIJs has norm at most 1, so the image under pi has norm at most norm of pi. Norm of C1, norm of pi, up to norm of pi times norm of CD, which is equal to pi, norm of pi to the dth power times C0 times C1 up to CD, which is less than or equal to k, norm of pi to the d times the norm of xij. Okay, so a very simple implication. And it's another example of why this factorization property is useful. Okay. Because it allows you to show, if you have this finite degree, that in fact every bounded representation is completely bounded, automatically. Okay. And in fact, that gives us an immediate corollary. tells us L of the disk algebra is infinity. In other words, you need arbitrarily long factorizations if you're going to get the norm. And the reason is that we know that there exists T polynomially bounded, but not completely polynomially bounded. So you have this pi T of Z, or of P equals P to the T, has pi T finite, but pi T CB equals infinity. So there's no D. Okay, there can be no D. All right.
But that won't explain the name of a similarity at all.
No, you want to know why similarity degree?
Yes, this is a name for that, but you don't need a similarity.
Of course there is, of course there is. If you have a bounded, let me make this remark here to answer Troy's question, right? If you have, if D of A is finite, then every bounded representation pi from A to B of H is completely bounded. Okay? And therefore, by Paulson's theorem, there exists an S with norm of S times norm of S inverse equal to norm of pi CB, so therefore less than or equal to K times norm of pi to the D, so that S pi S inverse is completely contractive representation. So that's exactly what this is good for. Okay? It's called similarity degree because those things are similar to completely contractive representations automatically. And that was a question. I mean, once you know that there are examples like the disk algebra around where you have bounded representations that aren't completely bounded, you want to know, well, are there algebras around which have the property that every bounded representation is completely bounded? And there are. Okay, so for example, nuclear C star algebras. Okay.
But that still say that D could just any real number instead of an integer here.
Well, yes.
Real number.
Patience. Oops. I'm on the wrong page. So I'm supposed to go up there. Unital operator algebra, following our equivalent, let me get the obvious order here, okay, 1, length of A is finite, 2, the degree, am I going the right direction? Yeah, we know length, we just proved that the length finite implies B of A is finite. Okay. 3. The similarity property every bounded representation pi from A into B of H is completely bounded. Okay, but with no control over the norm. And 4, a number c greater than 1 such that every bounded representation pi with norm of pi less than or equal to c is completely bounded. Okay. And in the case that these conditions hold, we have that L of A equals D of A. Okay. So this in particular contains the perhaps surprising information that this D here has to be an integer. Okay. I mean, you can certainly imagine that for any real number D, you can have an inequality like this. Okay. But this theorem shows that what happens in practice is that the optimal D is always an integer. Yes? Yeah, well, I mean, to say it's similar to degree, it wouldn't be well defined if I didn't say it was small as possible, that's all. Yeah, you could say the infimum, right? But then, of course, the infimum might not be attained. And in fact, it is attained, and it's an integer. Okay. All right. Well, I'm not going to be able to prove all of this, but what I can do is let's tell you something about the ideas involved and some of the consequences. So let's start with the gravy anyway, right? I mean, we just showed that D of L is less than L of L, so 1 implies 2 has been done, okay? And 2 does imply 3, obviously, okay, because not only is pi finite, pi bounded imply pi CB bounded, but it gives you control. And then 3 implies 4. You only have it for representations which are sufficiently small. Okay. And the other part of the easy part, 4 implies that there exists a constant M, finite, so that norm of pi less than or equal to C implies that the CB norm of pi is less than or equal to m. Why? Well, otherwise, you'd have a sequence of them, pi n from A into B of H representations. Norm of pi n less than or equal to C, pi n CB bigger than n. And then just take the direct sum. And pi n is clear, is less than or equal to c, but pi is not completely bounded. So that'd be a contradiction. Okay. That's it for the easy stuff. Okay. So let me say something about universal operator algebras. So if I have A as an operator algebra, then it could conceivably have a variety of different norms on it, on the men by n matrices that made it into an operator algebra. Okay. And it has the biggest one. And we can use this factorization degree to get a handle on that. Okay. So you can define the norm of a matrix Aij, say it's an n by n matrix. Let's call it a triple norm. Again, to be the nth of the product of Ci's I equals 0 to D, D greater or equal to 1, and Aij is given C0, D1, C1, D2, etc. Usual setup, Ci scalar, Di diagonal, entries in the unit ball. Okay. So, triple norm is an operator algebra norm. And you check the BRS conditions, it's exactly the same argument. And I guess if I hadn't said countable, I can say obviously the unit ball of an operator algebra is a semigroup, discrete semigroup under multiplication. I never used countable anywhere. Okay, so you don't have to actually check it again, I guess. So anyway, this is an operator algebra norm, and we call it, I'm going to call this norm Max A for max algebra. Okay. And it's called max algebra because if you have another family, is a family of operator algebra norms. Extending the usual one on A, then it's smaller than this one by the same argument as before. Then the norm of Aij is again less than the norm of C0 times the norm of D1 up to the norm of Cd. And again, it's less than the nth of over all those things. So this turns out to be the triple norm. Okay, so there is among all possible operator algebra structures one can put on the Banach algebra A, if it has an operator algebra structure, there's the biggest one and this is it. Have these D norms, okay, and these D norms that come, that they're this, it's still there conveniently, and if I look at D plus 1, then that's less than or equal to the norm of Aijd. For the obvious reason that if you have a factorization of length D, you can always extend it to be longer by putting in a diagonal with the identity element down the diagonal and then the identity matrix. So you get more factorizations if you allow longer length, and therefore your chance of a smaller infimum. And because this is the this infimum is over all products for arbitrary D, it's kind of obvious then that Aij max A is the limit of Aij D. Okay. And then we just make a note that the length of A is less than or equal to D, if and only if you have that the D norm is less than or equal to the constant times the usual norm.
You assume the algebra
with the identity. Yeah. Always unital. Everything's unital, see?
And also the scalar matrix must have the same norm as the operator
algebra norm. Yeah, it's the usual norm on matrices.
To keep the same norm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm just having to decide what I'm going to do. PCA has an even more general construction of an operator algebra than the one from the semi group. He says, take E to be any operator space. Okay. Then he forms a Fock space. F of E, which is a formal sum, C direct sum E direct sum E tensor E, E tensor 3 times. So this is usually written as a sum n greater than or equal to 0 of the sum of E tensor with itself n times. Now this is the algebra tensor product, no norms on there yet, okay? And then he puts a multiplication. I mean, it's a obvious as an obvious linear structure, but you can put a multiplication where you say E1 tensor EN circle dot F1 tensor Fm is defined to be E1 tensor En tensor F1 tensor Fm. So this gives you a product from E tensor N times E tensor M times to E tensor M plus N times. Okay, so for any operator space with just a linear structure, we build a formal algebra, okay? And then he says, okay, how are we going to norm this thing? Well, he says you take C from E into B of H, a linear map, and we're always going to want this to be completely bounded, so let's just say C, B map right away. Okay, and then I define pi c from f of e into b of h by defining it on elementary tensors by the product and you extend stop good you extend by linearity and pi c is an algebra homomorphism Okay? It's the only thing you could have done to be make it an algebra homomorphism. And then, for any c bigger than 0, we define norms, but let's just go on matrices. This one here would be an MN of F of E. Okay, with a little c here, this is the soup of the norms of the matrix of pi c of xij, such that CB of norm of phi is less than or equal to C. So I get a family of things, and then I complete it, and I get OA sub C of E. And again, it's an operator algebra, because I'm taking a soup over a bunch of operator algebra representations. This does not require BRS. Okay. All right, so I have a few little notes, what I call notes, but they take a couple pages, so I'll be brief. Okay. The first note is that OAC of E is equal to OA1 of EC, where the norm of X in the EC norm is C times the norm of X in the E norm. Okay. So, because it's sometimes convenient to be only looking at completely contractive maps instead of worrying about some C. Two, if I have X in F of E, okay, you can write X is a direct sum of Xn, where these Xn's belong to e to the tensor to the n. Okay. And then you can define a map gamma n of x equals xn. And gamma n cb is equal to 1. And the reason that this is true, I mean, it's obviously norm at least 1, but the point is that suppose I take a pi c, which is a completely isometric isomorphism of OA, c of E. Okay, if I take means the direct sum of these over a sufficiently large family will do it. Okay, you get a completely isometric representation. Okay, well then, for each lambda in the circle, you also have lambda CCB is equal to CCB is less than or equal to C. In fact, equal to C. It's going to have to be equal to C. Okay. And so therefore, pi of lambda phi is also a contractive. Oh, sorry, is a contractive representation, a completely contractive representation of OA C of E for each circle. But what does lambda do? Okay. Pi lambda phi of Xn is lambda to the n Xn, because it's coming from the tensor product of n elements of E, or a linear combination of tensor products of n elements of E. And so when I replace phi by lambda phi, it multiplies each of those EIs by lambda, and hence multiplies the whole thing by lambda. And so that means that you can recover xn as an integral, gamma n of x is equal to this integral from 0 to 2 pi, 1 over 2 pi, of e to the minus I n theta, pi of e to the I theta c of x d theta. And that's obviously a completely contractive thing, okay, because it's an average of completely contractive things. Okay. The third thing is that we can get a factorization for, I'm going to skip that part, because I'm not going to be able to give the proof. Okay, yeah. I'm going to skip my next point. Okay, third point has to do with the Hogarth tensor product. Okay, this is a lecture in itself, so obviously I'm not doing all the details here. Okay, but what is the Hogarth tensor product? You have E and F operator spaces. Okay, then you can put a norm on E tensor F by, or MN of T tensor F by the norm of Xij. Hogarth norm is the infimum over the norm of a matrix Eik in the E's times a matrix Fkj in the F's, such that Xij is obtained as this tensor product in this way. So this is a tensor product norm which is set up to be good for matrix multiplication. Okay. So just a few facts about this. This is a norm. Okay. Has to be checked. Tensor product is associative, but not commutative. Well, of course it's not commutative because it's like matrix multiplication. Okay. All right. And if I take E, tensor with itself n times, with the Hogarth norm, and I can inject this into OA1 of E, because OA1 of E contains E to the n, then this is a complete isometry. Why? Because the norms are defined in the same way, essentially. Okay. Well, injection. If I have xn in E tensor to the n here, then in fact I have xn in its n norm is the same as xn in the operator algebra norm. This being the factorization norm. Because the Hogarth norm is precisely the factorization norm using exactly n terms. Okay. All right. And then the other thing I want to observe is that, again, if xn, and this should be m some matrix, okay? If xn is in mk of e tensored n, right? Then xn in the C norm is just C to the n times xn in the Hogarth norm. And that's because of the C that goes through that allows you to put in C times the identity. Okay, and I won't go through that. All right, that takes care of my notes. So we get to the hard part, okay? So just to remind you, so the hard part is that we have pi from A to B of H, pi less than or equal to pi less than or equal to C implies pi CB is less than or equal to M. Okay, that's the setup. Okay. Then I want to claim that if we choose D so that C to the D times C minus 1 is bigger than M, then L of A is less than or equal to D. Okay, so once I know that, once I know that, once we have this, then D of A finite implies that L of A is finite. Okay, because that's 2 goes to 3 goes to 4 goes to 1. Okay, because this is the 4 goes to 1 step. Okay. But then, all right, what we also have, all right, so if we have, so we have 4 implies 1 from this claim implies 2. Okay, so 4 also implies that D of A is finite. Okay. And now we want to know that they're the same. Okay. But 2 implies 4 for all C with M equal to constant times C to the D. Okay, so then we have to look, let me call that D0 to distinguish it from my other one. So then I'm looking for a D so that C to the D times C minus 1 is bigger than K times C to the D0. Okay, well, I claim I can just take D equal to D0 and take C bigger than K plus 1. Okay, so what? So in other words, I have to go through the cycle twice. But once I know that 4 implies 1, then I know I have 4 with using D of A and a constant by going through the whole cycle, and then I can use this lemma again for a bigger C, one that's big enough so that I get that this D that I can prove is the same as the D0 that I have here. Okay? Alright. Alright, now what can I do? Here's the idea, okay? So I have OAC of A, which of course is OA1 of AC, where AC is A as an operator space with the norm multiplied by C. And I have identity map from AC to A is clearly contractive. Okay. So it induces pi of ID from OAC of A onto A. Okay. And so, in fact, A is isomorphic to OAC of A modulo J, where J is the kernel. Let me call this pi tilde. Pi identity looks a little weird. Okay. All right. So, therefore, we get this map pi tilde inverse, mapping A into, they call it pi tilde tilde to OAC of A mod J. Okay. This is a algebra isomorphism. And what is the norm of that map? The norm of pi tilde tilde inverse of A is the norm of A plus J. The norm of A plus J is less than the image of anything which is mapped onto A by this map. Okay. And in particular, it takes A to itself. Okay. So one thing that maps onto A plus J is the image of A in A. There are other things out there in A tensor A and A tensor A tensor A and linear combinations of those things. Lots of stuff can map to A, but in particular this maps to A, and it's the quotient norm is the inf over all possible things. So it's smaller than this one, and this one is C times A. So pi tilde tilde inverse is less than or equal to C in norm. And that means, by our hypothesis, that pi tilde tilde inverse CB is less than or equal to M. Because this is an operator algebra, because the quotient of an operator algebra is an algebra. That's something that we didn't discuss, but it's something that follows from the Bletcher-Ron-Sinclair axioms. It's easy to see that the quotient of an operator algebra satisfies the BRS axioms. And therefore, it also can be represented completely isometrically as an operator algebra. So this makes sense. Okay. Now I'm going to have to wave my hands a bit. But now let's take some Xij and Mn of A with the norm of Xij strictly less than 1 over M. Okay, so therefore, the norm of pi inverse tilde tilde of Xij is less than 1. Okay, so therefore Xij is pi tilde of some x, where x belongs to, f of A, and norm of x in OAC of A is less than 1. Because again, this is a quotient norm, and so this is, so I can find something that's in the image that maps onto this that's less than 1, and in fact it's easy to see that this dense subalgebra maps on, but it's probably a point that's not even important. And then you can write x as x0 plus x1 plus x2, where these xi's belong to A tensored with itself I times. OK. Okay. And by one of my remarks, it's still right there, it's the norm for these Xi's in OA of C is less than or equal to the norm of X, which is less than 1. And then by that corollary up there, this implies that the norm of pi of Xi, which is the norm of X I in OA1 of A, the Hogarth norm, is equal to C to the minus I times norm of Xi in OA C. So that's less than C to the minus I. So I've got now my Xij is a sum pi tilde of x0 plus pi tilde of x1 plus, and that's a geometric series. Okay? And now it's just technical. The point is that you pull off the first d terms and you get a certain approximate, which and the point is, because of this corollary up there, the first one, all of those terms are bounded in the d norm, the factorization d norm, if I just go up to d. The rest of the stuff is small, so I get close. Then I take what's left over and I approximate it. And I take what's left over and approximate it. And in the end, I get something in the limit. It's written down in Verne's book, but he has a little lemma that he claims there that is missing a hypothesis, but it's a hypothesis that we've got. All right, there has to be some comparison of these two norms. I think it's 19.10 is the lemma. So there's a bit of an issue there. PJ's book also has it. Okay, and that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to instead talk about some examples of this theory. Okay. Now, a lot of this stuff was done before PGA similarity degree. So we have a theorem of Bunce and Christensen independently with somewhat different estimates. But they show that if A is a nuclear C-star algebra and pi mapping A into B of H is a bounded representation, then norm of pi CB is less or equal to a constant. They got different constants, and I didn't look them up, so times norm of pi squared. So this means that i.e. L of A is less or equal to 2. PCA has worked hard to prove the converse. But if A is a C-star algebra and L of A is less than or equal to 2, then A is semi-nuclear. Anyway, almost nuclear, but he couldn't quite. Anyway, it's a condition that's close to that. And then, which happened earlier, came short not that long after Christensen, you have a very deep result of Uffe-Hogarth. Okay, and what he says is that if you have any C-star algebra, pi from A to B of H, a cyclic representation. So what does cyclic mean? I.e., there exists a vector x in H so that pi of A x closure is the whole Hilbert space. Okay, now you wouldn't think that you would have to stop at cyclic, but anyway, then pi CB is less than or equal to norm of pi cubed. Okay. And he gets as a corollary that if A has no traceable states, then L of A is less than or equal to 3. In other words, you can do this for every representation, and, well, the proof is, basically he shows that you can take a representation pi, and you can extend that to a normal representation of its double dual, which is a von Neumann algebra, which is a von Neumann algebra with no finite part. And therefore, it contains a copy of O infinity, and therefore, every representation, every J convolutional generated representation is cyclic, which is certainly enough. You only have to look at one vector, so it can be approximated by some finite linear combination. But like, for instance, B of H, right, contains O infinity, so you have S1 up to S2 isometries, pairwise orthogonal ranges, okay, and if you have a representation pi with a cyclic set x1, x2, x3 unit vectors, then you can write down x to be the summation of, say, 2 to the minus n sn xn, right, and there you have a vector. And Sn star x is equal to 2 to the minus n xn, so you get all those vectors back. So that's a cyclic vector. So you get a corollary due to PZA is that L of B of H is 3, because Holbrook said it's less than or equal to 3, and it doesn't satisfy the semi-nuclear condition of PZA. Okay. And there are similar things for group representations. I mean, so PZA showed that if you have a representation of a group, if you can show that that the complete bound norm on that representation is bounded by a constant times norm of pi squared, then in fact it's amenable. But what he can't show is that there might not be some other groups with a finite similarity degree. We'll stop there. That's the end of the course. And by the way, that gets us to the last page of Paulson's book, although we did have to skip an awful lot in order to get there.